back to another edition of the Prepper Recon Podcast. Our mission is to bring you great interviews with preppers from around the world so you can be better informed and better prepared for everything from a hurricane to the end of the world as we know it. Whether your plan is to bug out or bug in, CampingSurvival.com has all of your preparedness needs, including fish antibiotics, long-term storage food, water filters, bug-out bags, and first aid kits. Use coupon code PREPPERRECON for 5% off your entire order at CampingSurvival.com.
When disaster strikes, it's too late to prepare. PrepperRecon.com offers MOLLE-compatible individual first aid kits for your home, auto, or bug-out bag. These kits have everything you need to address a traumatic injury, including an Israeli battle dressing, quick clot, EMT shears, suture kit, Steri-Strips, tourniquet, ACS chest seal, tough strip bandages, gauze, and so much more. $89 includes shipping. To buy your individual first aid kit, go to PrepperRecon.com and click the store tab at the top of the homepage. Order today before it's too late.
Today's guest is Dr. Peter Pry. Dr. Pry served on the Congressional EMP Commission and worked as a CIA employee and as a nuclear strategist. He's written two books on EMP, Apocalypse Unknown and Electronic Armageddon. Dr. Pry, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've actually written three books. My third book, Blackout Wars, was published just before Thanksgiving.
Oh, fantastic. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Blackout Wars is basically about two things. First, it puts EMP in the context of this new military doctrine that has been developed by the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, and the Iranians. You know, they all pattern their new military doctrine, which they call different things. I call it a blackout war. You know, they call it total information warfare. Some of the U.S. Army War College call it Cybergeddon. Patterned after the Russian doctrine, and basically this new way of warfare, which they term a revolution in military affairs, envisions attacking electric grids, crash all the critical infrastructures, because everything in society depends directly or indirectly on electricity, communications, business and industry, telecommunications, transportation, food and water. All of it depends directly or indirectly upon electricity, the electric grid. So the idea is, instead of fighting the Marines or fighting the U.S. Navy and Air Force, is to go around, instead of attacking us at our strength, to attack us at our technological Achilles heel by striking at the electric grid. Because we, our military, too, 99% of our electrical energy and most of the energy that is needed for us to project power and wage war also comes from the civilian electric grid and from the telecommunication systems and all the civilian critical infrastructures. All of that, if that collapses, our military collapses also. So the idea is to use a sort of a blitzkrieg in cyberspace, you know, which is a combined arms that would use cyber attacks as we think of them, you know, viruses and computer viruses and computer hacking, combined with physical sabotage, sending in commandos to actually attack transformer substations, non-nuclear EMP weapons, so-called radio frequency weapons, which have a smaller radius than a nuclear EMP attack, much smaller radius, you know, but could also be used by commandos. And finally, in the ultimate cyber weapon, and this is vital for Americans to understand, when we're talking about the adversary view, the way the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, and the Iranians think about cyber warfare, they don't think of it as limited to computer viruses and hacking. It includes all these things that I've described, including a nuclear EMP attack, a high-altitude nuclear EMP attack. And that is where you set off a single nuclear weapon, basically in outer space, at such a high altitude that if it's over, 200 kilometers over the center of the United States, up in the sky, it's so high you wouldn't even hear the blast. On a cloudy day, you wouldn't see the flash. There'd be nothing, no blast, no thermal effects on the ground, no fallout effects on the ground. So you wouldn't even know you'd been attacked by that a nuclear weapon had gone off up there. But it would generate this electromagnetic pulse, which is a super energetic radio wave that will fry electronics across the whole continental United States, cause the electric grid to collapse, cause all the civilian critical infrastructure to collapse. It's their ace in the hole cyber warfare attack. And all the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, the Iranians have written about this in their military doctrine, and we have seen them practice it. As we speak, as a matter of fact, there's a North Korean satellite called the KSM-3 that was orbited over the United States during the worst ever nuclear crisis we had with North Korea back in 2013. It still passes over us every few days at the optimum altitude for doing a nuclear EMP attack, evading our national missile defenses. So they practice this. The North Koreans actually practice this against us, and we can see the evidence of this practice fly over our heads every few days. So that's the first part of the book about the, trying to explain this revolution in military affairs. In fact, the adversary sees this as the greatest revolution in military affairs in history, and I agree with them, because what is a revolution in military affairs? It's when a side, the way the Russians lay this out, there's a book called The History of Military Art, and it looks at the evolution of warfare across the centuries and sees history in terms of a series of revolutions in military affairs where civilization has come up with a new technology and a new way of fighting war that is so decisive that it enables that civilization to replace another civilization. So the early city-states of Mesopotamia are replaced by the first empires like Egypt and the Persian Empire that figure out that you can, by using mass agriculture, you can raise mass armies and build new technologies. You've got enough wealth to build new technologies like chariots so that you can overwhelm these small city-states and turn them into the first empire. And they, in turn, are defeated by the Greeks under Alexander the Great, who comes up with the Macedonian phalanx and knows how to use cavalry in ways that nobody else had thought of before, and has also got a military genius at its head, which eclipses these early agricultural empires with the Hellenistic Age. And so you have a period of when Greek civilization dominates that because of this combination of a better strategy and better technology. The Greeks, in turn, are surpassed by the Roman legions that have the innovation of primitive field artillery, roads, and an economy, the kinds of cities that were supported by aqueduct systems that could support even bigger and more sophisticated armies, and on, the invention of gunpowder and cannon causing feudal Europe to be replaced by the first monarchies, those in turn superseded by the rise of early republican and democratic systems like in republican France. So Napoleon had at his disposal massed citizen armies, so you could put into the field, instead of small professional armies, hundreds of thousands of people in a massed citizen army. The first scientific war, World War One, the use of machine guns, barbed wire trenches, chemical warfare, where you basically harnessed the industrial and scientific base of a society, to create a new revolution in military affairs, which destroys the Victorian civilization and replaces it with these new, very threatening civilizations in the Soviet Union, Nazi Germany. Nazi Germany is one of the most famous revolutions in military affairs, where they come up with the Blitzkrieg, the idea of using tanks and fast-moving infantry, mobile artillery, and air power in combination in a way that nobody else had conceived before. Whereas the Western democracies were still thinking of World War One and fighting trench warfare. And this innovative use of technology and strategy enables them to almost conquer the world. But they're stopped from doing it because the Allies have to figure out with the lives of their soldiers at great cost, how to fight a better blitzkrieg in the deserts of North Africa and the Russian front. And so our civilization is saved from being defeated in this revolution of military affairs. Then the nuclear missile age, the invention of nuclear weapons, the Soviet Union saw itself, and in the revolution, in this book I'm speaking of, The History of Military Art, they predicted that they were going to win that latest revolution in military affairs because they believed you could fight and win a nuclear war. Fortunately, they turned out to be wrong, and we managed to outthink them on the nuclear chessboard and come up with ways of deterring the Soviet Union until it collapsed of its own weight. But now, the next chapter, it's actually the book that follows the revolution in military affairs textbook that's taught in the Russian Voroshilov Academy, there's a book called No Contact Wars by this book postulates this new greatest revolution in military affairs. And why is it the greatest revolution? Well, because it entails not even having to fight a battle against an enemy's adversaries the way you did in the rest of history. You go after the most vulnerable part of society, the technological Achilles heel, you know, which will enable you to collapse a whole civilization without actually fighting a battle, by going after the electric grid, by these various means that I described earlier, computer viruses, physical sabotage, and nuclear EMP attack. You can achieve this victory and replace one civilization with another with a very small number of people. You know, it doesn't take that many people to do the computer virus attacks, handful of saboteurs to go after the electric grid. You know, the U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission did a report that said of just 9 key transformer substations, if you could figure out which 9 key transformer substations out of 2,000 to attack, you know, you could collapse the whole U.S. electric grid for 18 months, you know, which would end up killing most of the American population. And then, of course, the nuclear EMP attack, which is the ultimate threat. You only need one bomb. You know, you could deliver that. You don't need a sophisticated bomb. It could be any kind of a nuclear weapon. It could be delivered. It doesn't need a sophisticated delivery system. You know, using a Scud missile or a medium-range missile launched off a freighter, you know, you could reach the center of the United States. And you don't even need to do the iconic attack where it's detonated over the center of the United States. Really, anywhere detonated over the eastern half of the United States, you know, even of a coastal area, would probably collapse the eastern grid, you know, which generates 75% of our electricity, and that would be it for us. You know, we can't survive without 75% of our electricity, even if the Western and Texas grids remain intact. I should explain that the U.S. grid is divided into 3 parts, the Eastern, Western, and Texas grids, and the Eastern grid is the most important. It's what supports most of our population. So it's the greatest revolution in military affairs in history because it's the easiest to implement. It creates a situation that has never existed before in history where a failed state like a North Korea or Iran, you know, would be able to take out the most sophisticated and advanced societies on the planet, the United States or any of the European countries. In the past, even if the bad guys at least had to be competent enough to be able to put big armies and efficient armies into the field, you know, Nazi Germany wouldn't have been a threat if it hadn't been a great scientific and industrial power. So as bad as the society might have been ethically, you know, they had to at least have mastered industrial capabilities and scientific capabilities and have enough wealth to pose a serious threat to Western civilization. Not so anymore. You know, like I said, a failed state like a North Korea that can't even feed its own people could in fact execute this kind of an attack and triumph over the Western civilization. Terrorists, it wouldn't even have to be a nation state. If terrorists got their hands on a bomb and a medium-range missile, or even a balloon. You know, there are meteorological balloons that can reach the proper altitude. But anyway, I'm going down at too much great length. This is the first part of the book, explaining this new threat that we face, this concept of the blackout war. But the other half of the book, ultimately, is a good news story. It talks about what people can do in their own states, not looking to Washington. You know, because I and others have been trying to solve this problem in Washington for many years. Perhaps this year we'll finally have made progress, but it's been many years that we've been warning about this and trying to get bills through Congress, and they never seem ultimately to get through. So a couple of years ago, back in 2013, my EMP task force, which is a congressional advisory board, we started going to the states. And it's amazing to me how much more progress we were able to make in the states. You know, we started in the state of Maine, and Maine state legislature had never even heard of EMP. But when we had a chance to educate them on this and explain how to solve the problems, it took them only 6 months, just 6 months, for Maine to pass the first bill that has ever been passed at the state level, for Maine to proceed to protect its electric grid from these threats. Because it can be done inexpensively, you know how to do it. You know, the problem has not been technological or monetary, you know, but it's been political. It's the politics of protecting the grid that makes it so hard. And Maine was the first state to do it. And subsequently, in just 2 years, we managed to get bills and progress made in other states as well, Florida, Virginia, Arizona, for example. And this is really contrasts with the how broken Washington is, where for 7 years, you know, we've tried unsuccessfully to make progress, and it took only 6 months when we started going to the states. And a lot of these state initiatives, you know, were begun by people, just normal citizens, you know, who got tired of waiting for Washington and said, I'm going to protect my state. I should also explain that it is possible to protect your state, even when the most states in the United States, almost all of them except Texas, are dependent on a larger regional grid. They're part of a larger regional grid, but you can island your grid, you know, by putting in the Faraday cages and surge arrestors and blocking devices, you know, the other technologies that are needed to protect transformers, generators, and SCADA systems. And so even though you're part of a larger regional grid, a state can actually protect itself, so the lights will stay on in that state, and the, all the critical infrastructures necessary to sustain a modern society and preserve life will stay on in that state, even if the other states are vulnerable and they go down. And, you know, on the cover of my book, I've got four of the states of the United States in light, you know, the ones that have taken measures to protect their grids so that they will be able to survive, you know, as they go forward, you know, while preparing themselves. And the book basically has many chapters written by the state legislators who actually took the initiatives and passed bills in their states, and it describes their experiences, the strategies they decided, what the legislation was, and it also offers other ideas about how you can do it in a state. A governor, for example, has got emergency powers. You wouldn't necessarily have to go through the state legislature. You know, legally, a governor could, through executive order, decide that he's going to order the utilities within his state to protect themselves. So it's basically a handbook, for a citizen's handbook, to explain what the threat is from man and nature. We haven't talked about the natural EMP threat yet, but what the threat is from man and nature, and how you could solve this problem at the state level, you know, and what average citizens can do to protect themselves and not wait on Washington. So that's what the book is about, Blackout Wars.
It's time for a quick break, and we'll be right back. The dollar's lost over 90% of its purchasing power since 1971. Silver, on the other hand, has proved to be a very stable form of wealth preservation over the years. And where do you buy silver? Silver.com, of course. Silver.com offers fantastic prices on silver and gold.
We talk a lot about food storage on the Prepper Recon podcast, but just as important is knowing that you have a way to cook the food that you're storing. Sun Oven is a great way to cook with the energy of the sun, and they have a great deal for Prepper Recon podcast listeners. It's $80 off a deluxe package, which includes a turkey roasting rack, especially for Thanksgiving and Christmas. Just go to PrepperRecon.com. And click the Sun Oven banner on the right-hand side of the homepage. You spoke a little bit about a physical attack against the grid. Recently, we just saw the Crimean Peninsula completely lose power for more than a week. You spoke about it being a coordinated effect along with cyber attacks or EMP or something like that. And I know that Crimea also had no cellular service during that period as well. Is that the sort of thing that you're talking about?
Crimea is a kind of a primitive example because they, you know, but it is an example, you know, because the rebels in eastern Ukraine knocked down transmission towers, I guess. And you know, and that's what caused that's what caused the blackout in Crimea. But there are better examples. It might also be questionable about, you know, was that a deliberate effort to black out the Ukraine? I mean, excuse me, the Crimea, because Crimea is now part of Russia, and it might have resulted from an accident, you know. But there are real, recent, good examples of the bad guys blacking out grids. Back in, it was a few days before Halloween, I believe in 2013, I think it was October 27th, 2013, a Sunday, that the Knights Templars, they're a terrorist drug cartel in Mexico, they used pipe bombs and explosives to attack transformer substations and create a temporary blackout of a large part of Mexico. They put about 500,000 people into the dark so they could go to the towns and villages and drag leaders opposed to the drug trade into the public squares and execute them publicly. Now, if Neanderthals like the Knights Templars, okay, have figured out that the electric grid is a major societal vulnerability, you know, that they could exploit with just crude explosives, you know, what have Al-Qaeda and ISIS and North Korea and China and Russia, these more sophisticated actors, Iran, what have they got in mind for us? That example was followed in June 2014, when most of the media, this was little reported on the press, because everybody was focused on ISIS, which was then, you know, a new terrifying phenomenon, still a terrifying phenomenon, but it was new on the scene. It was taking over northern Iraq in a startling way. Well, while that was happening, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula knocked down transmission towers. They used rocket-propelled grenade launchers and mortars to knock down transmission towers and put the whole nation of Yemen into a temporary blackout. You know, that was something like 18 cities and 20 million people, you know, put into the dark. And it had real consequences. I mean, it wasn't just an inconvenience, because it helped destabilize the Yemen government, which then fell. And the Yemen government has been taken over by terrorists friendly to Iran. So Yemen had been one of the most important U.S. allies, and geostrategically it's very important because of its location on the Red Sea, you know, along one of the areas for oil shipments. And, you know, they had been a staunch U.S. ally, and no more. They're gone. They're no longer a U.S. ally. And this blackout war that was conducted to them played an important role in undermining that government and leading to their collapse. Earlier this year, I believe it was the 20th of January of this year, a terrorist group blacked out 80% of Pakistan by using, again, physical attacks against transmission towers. And Pakistan is a nuclear weapons state. Turkey, I think it was in March of this year, was blacked out, allegedly, according to reports, by a cyber attack by Iran. So we've actually had real... everybody knows about all the cyber attacks that have been made against U.S. information systems. You know, tens of millions of federal employees having their personal information compromised by attacks from China. People need to put this into the context of the blackout war idea. You know, when that sort of thing happens, these raids by China and North Korea, and attacks by the Russians on our information systems, they shouldn't be seen as just an inconvenience. They are the tip of the spear. I think they're experiments. They're testing how good our defenses are, and they're also testing our reactions. And I think neither have been very good. You know, they learn over and over again that our defenses are not very good, and they're able to get in to our cyberspace, you know, by means of their cyber offensive capabilities. And then when we react, our reaction is extremely confused. I mean, there's a furious newspaper headlines. Congress gets upset. The White House declares that it's going to do something. And then ultimately nothing happens. Nothing is really done to improve that vulnerability, to protect that vulnerability. And we don't even retaliate. And so we're teaching the bad guys they can get away with this lower level of violence through the blackout war. And I think it's an extremely ominous sign when these things happen, because now let's go back to the German Blitzkrieg of World War II. You know, that used the that combined armor, air power, and fast mobile infantry, okay, to overwhelm the adversary. Part of the German Blitzkrieg operation, part of their strategy, they had a motorcycle corps that would go out way out in front of the armored divisions. And the motorcycle corps would scout out the weak parts of the Allied lines, you know, find holes in the lines so that the armored divisions can go pull car guard. So, you know, when we see these cyber attacks defined as we define them, computer viruses and hacking that steal people's information, that's just the tip of the spear. That's not the whole of it. That's the equivalent of looking up on a hill and seeing a German motorcycle soldier, motorcycle scout, looking down on your position, you know, that's how we should be perceiving this, you know, that that is not the whole of it. You know, it's practice for this new blitzkrieg, this on such a large scale against the United States, perhaps under this president that hasn't shown great will, you know, in terms of protecting our national security interests. This guy thinks that climate change is the biggest threat to our national security. I would beg to disagree with that. You know, I think almost every day we're experiencing the biggest threat to our national security in these unremitting cyber attacks that happen, thousands of them every day, against our national security agencies and against our civilian critical infrastructures. I think they're the leading edge for what someday is going to turn into be a blackout war that could end us as a civilization. Other because the war doesn't have to last a long time. You know, you can collapse the other guy's electric grid and his critical infrastructures basically in 24 hours. And and that would create conditions where one civilization could replace another in historically record time, instead of having a war that would go on for years and years. So that is the threat that we're talking about from man, and those are the significance of those of the events such as you mentioned in Crimea. You know, I think that we see the evidence of the of our potential adversaries practicing this already. I mentioned the North Korean satellite. Iran has also practiced nuclear EMP attacks by launching Shahab-3s to altitudes. They've launched like five of them to high altitude. I'm at the EMP commission in which I served. He said that, you know, that there was no other explanation, you know, for what the Iranians were doing. You know, it was a clear, classic sign of them practicing to see if they could have the triggering mechanisms right, the fusing mechanisms, so they could detonate a warhead at high altitude to do an EMP attack. Now, they haven't conducted any nuclear detonations at high altitude. You know, it's assessed that Iran doesn't have the bomb yet. I personally don't believe that. I've written articles about this. There's many experts who actually think that Iran already has the bomb. But that's another topic to discuss perhaps at some future practice at China and Russia. It's part of their military doctrines. You know, they've got forces dedicated to doing nuclear EMP attacks. All of these things in combination, they've practiced, just like the Germans used to practice their blitzkrieg. In fact, that's another reason to be concerned about these cyber attacks we're experiencing, because, you know, before World War II, Nazi Germany practiced with its blitzkrieg. During the Spanish Civil War, you know, they conducted exercises and they actually participated in the Spanish Civil War in a low-profile way, you know, not dramatic enough to raise the alarm of anybody but Winston Churchill and the small number of advisors that surrounded him. I mean, Churchill and a handful of guys in the West, handful of generals and military specialists saw what was coming with the blitzkrieg, but there were too few of them. And they were dismissed by the elites at the time as being alarmists and not knowing what they were talking about. Until the blitzkrieg happened and the Western civilization nearly fell to it and proved that they were right. I think we're in a similar situation now where we're sort of in the period 1936 to 39, you know, where the bad guys are experimenting with the blackout war right now in a low-profile way, to see how vulnerable we are, to see how we react to it, you know, to set us up for 0 hour, you know, when it finally comes.
That's the end of the first half of my interview with Dr. Peter Pry. Tune in next week for the rest of the show. God bless and happy prepping.
In the days of Noah, Book 3, Perdition, a global empire arises like a phoenix from the ashes of the world that was. The emerging order is unified by a new global currency and a single world religion, which are mandated by an imposed UN treaty. In the interest of unity and peace, a zero-tolerance policy for dissenters is enacted and strictly enforced. Hunted down like common criminals for daring to resist the state, Noah Parker's group will have to rely on faith and wits to endure counter the powers of darkness which are quickly consuming the earth. Buy your copy of The Days of Noah, Book 3, Perdition, by best-selling author Mark Goodwin in paperback, Kindle, or audio edition from Amazon.com today.